If you're enjoying this podcast, please leave us a review and tap the follow button so that you never miss an episode.
Welcome, everyone.
Hello, hello, everyone. Happy Monday. It's the best time of the week. How are you doing, Sasha?
I'm doing well, Helen. How are you?
I am doing wonderful. Anything new going on in your wonderful life?
Well, it's Tuesday morning here, so I can assure everybody Tuesday comes. It's a really good day of the week.
Not Monday.
I always get my head confused with this time difference thing. So it's Monday evening for you guys. It's Tuesday morning for us, and the world keeps spinning. How's things been for you last week?
Things have been pretty good this past week. No complaints. The world didn't fall apart. So, you know, I call that a plus. So anyway, you ready to get this thing started? Without further ado, I'm going to go ahead and introduce our guest. Our guest is David Teachout. He was here last week and he's back because we made him do this. Anyway, David is a mental health therapist and photographer focused on teaching and how creativity intersects with mental flexibility and working through the inevitable difficulties in life. David grew up as a Christian fundamentalist, attending a Bible college and receiving a bachelor's in theology and psychology. During his studies there, David deconverted and has been on a journey of more deeply appreciating the many nuances of humanity ever since. David has a master's in both forensic psychology and counseling psychology, and is currently working on a doctorate in clinical psychology. Damn, bro, that's a lot of degrees. Wow, I'm impressed. David has actively been working in the field of psychology as a therapist, social worker, advocate, and subject matter expert for over 15 years. So, David, let's get this thing started. You can go ahead and unmute yourself and let's get going.
Thank you, Helen. It is a lot of degrees, and I have the student loan debt to prove it. So it's fine. Yeah, some people have mortgages. Some people have degrees. It's all a wash. I will make a separate plug as well for the Secular Therapy Project, not only because I'm on it, but because it is quite an amazing program filled with a lot of great experts. Helping people out, and I will be the first to attest to the number of clients that I work with already around religious trauma and religious informed issues that having a therapist that is aware of and will not immediately go to religious quotations with you can be extremely encouraging and freeing. Not that I can't work, of course, speaking personally, with religious clients, it is one of those things that when you can really speak the language and understand how some of this stuff works, it's hugely helpful. So highly recommend that. So 2 weeks in a row.
You just love being here, man. I love listening to yourself talk. That's why you keep showing up.
I love you, Helen.
I love you too, David. That's why we're friends.
And for anyone who missed last week's discussion, can you sum that up in a couple of sentences, David, what you all discussed last week and how we can find the copy
of it? It was not a heavy subject at all.
It was not. It was very light. It was practically cream cheese. It was primarily about the new task force that this organization has developed around the abortion angle and the reason in fostering some support and resources around people and for people across the nation in light of the recent Supreme Court ruling concerning abortion access, and really making sure that one, people are supported regardless of one's proclivities ideologically. But as well to foster further conversation and support around just conversation and making sure that people can find the resources that are needed in the midst of what is undoubtedly a continuing unfolding, craziness that is the legal landscape that we are living in. I'm reminded of the Klingon curse. May you live in interesting times. We are in the midst of it. So we're
it's
here to help.
It's exhausting living in interesting times.
Yeah. And I'm sure a lot of that will tie in with today's presentation as well. Yes. Maybe to set the theme, we have a poll that we put to all of our guests that kind of sets the theme with some of the topics that you're going to cover in the presentation. Can we launch that poll and feel free, everyone who's here live today, to participate in the answers?
Thank you, Sasha. I almost forgot. Sasha's right. The other part of my brain.
No, thank you to Kara behind the scenes. So if we can launch that poll now, and then that might help everyone understand the theme of where David's going to go this evening with his presentation. Now, where is that poll?
Launch poll. There you go. I launched it.
All right. Feel free to put your answers in there. Helen, can you run through those questions for us? And I think this will really help get the theme for what David's going to discuss.
Okay, so tonight the topic is the psychology of abortion. Nothing is simple. One, have you had a personal experience, whether you or in relation to another, in connection to an abortion? Answers are yes, no, likely, but not sure, or I work in services related to it. Number two, do you consider abortion to be purely a religious question? Number one, yes. No, depends on the religion, depends on whether we're talking about abortion or contraception or C and D. Number three, is the social question of abortion tied directly to the issues of socially prescribed sex roles? Yes, no, the binary here is obnoxious. And seriously, how could this not be related? And number four, the most important question on the survey, who is your favorite Stranger Things character? Mike, 11, Dustin, Lucas, Nancy, Jonathan, Joyce, Jim Hopper, or other, we're gonna call that the Demogorgon.
We needed another question in there, or another answer. What Stranger Things?
Oh, I'm a Dustin fan myself. He always makes me happy, but you know, I'm biased. So anyway, now that we got all that out of the way, I would like David to please continue why abortion in this discussion is not a simple conversation.
Absolutely. Yeah, I have to say, putting together the poll questions, I was going to go with a fourth serious one. I'm like, I can't do this to everybody. I can't. Yes. I'm just going to say Dustin's probably one of my favorites, largely because he's cooler than I ever hoped to be. So, yeah. It's
Life goals, man.
It totally is. The topic here, abortion psychology, we're definitely will discuss issues related to sexuality as well. But again, as it relates back to, you know, abortion itself. And as anybody who's seen me present before, which at this point I think might be 8, so close to 10, gonna get a t-shirt. Is that the subtitle of Nothing is Simple really should just be the subtitle of like everything I speak about. I have a visceral reaction to anything that is portrayed as being easy, simple, basic, of course that's how it is. I get hives internally. It's ugly. So, and I have no hair. So the hives are very obvious. So it's just the way it works.
That's why the hair fell out, man.
Well, yeah. Actually, I was talking with Rob about this the other, I think one of the previous presentations. And I was like, you can literally see the progression of the presentations I've given in the progression of the hair loss. So I'm blaming RFR for this. This is how this works. Yeah. In the spirit of looking at the complications, I will try to post as much as possible. I know there's several links that will be posted as we go on and at the end around resources, around psychological studies and so on that are related to abortion. And highly recommend reading through them as much as possible. I will reference multiple papers, and at the end, I'll see if I can actually post all of them as well. Sometimes you might have access to them, sometimes you might not, depending on school affiliation and whatnot. But I have some quotes from all of them as well. And that actually begins the complications around this. And one of the things, and again, anytime, doesn't matter who the source is. The source is secular, source is religious, does not matter. Anybody who starts any of these conversations with, I know the answer to this, likelihood is they don't, or at the very least it's self-serving, and it's not going to be ultimately helpful for anybody involved. So you're going to hear from me a lot of and a lot of it depends, and a lot of depends on this kind of categorization here, because when it comes to studies on this, to say that it is barren with possibility is just the way it is. It's very difficult to find some legitimate. There's a lot of studies. They're all very small. So, for instance, majority of what I'm finding, is related to the first trimester. Which makes sense because that's the predominant time frame in which the abortion procedure typically occurs. Most of the studies involve very few people, and by few I will mean like less than a dozen, which in my mind is difficult to even, why are you publishing it? But I have extra high annoying standards. And so any kind of definitive assessments out of these things are really difficult to really be able to say in a way that would at all be helpful. At the same time, there's a lot of illusions and there's a lot of indications around things. You just have to be really difficult whenever coming across. And so when you hear people say, there is no mental health issues related to abortion. Depends, and we'll get into why that depends. Or on the reverse, like women are always devastated whenever this occurs. Anytime, always puts in there, you have to really be like, eh. But as well, sometimes, yeah, actually, it is pretty terrible. And we'll go into actually some indications of why that happens as well. I believe Sasha had a point.
Yeah, David, I was just going to ask along those lines, we're talking about some of the studies and the research that's done. Are you saying that often these are coming from a place of a biased conclusion and that some of these studies are trying to find an answer that fits with a predetermined conclusion, or where are you drawing a lot of your research and experience from when it comes to these sorts of studies?
Yeah, a lot of it is as much public that it can. So PubMed is a great source, National Institutes of Science is another. There's a lot of places, APA. In fact, that is one that I was able to reference. The APA actually had an entire task force that they put together around mental health and its relationship to abortion. They did, I believe it was 20 years of longitudinal studies following over 1,000 women. So really, really good information in that. Even there, I will say that I at least personally have some quibbles over some of the languaging involved. There's clearly a ideological bias, and I say that with the utmost of affection because I don't inherently believe a bias is bad. I think it's inevitable, but the only thing we can do is try to be as aware of it as possible and its influence. So it's not a criticism per se so much as it is just an awareness that some of the ways that things get worded at times can showcase the fact they're going for a particular bent. That being said as well, totally other, that would be very off topic, but as far as like just studies in general, the social sciences have been going through quite a difficult period in the last decade or so of replication crisis. There's been some interesting criticisms of that criticism. I don't buy it, but that's me. And so basically anything that's here, you take with a big old brick of salt whenever you're coming across, like, you know, this social science experiment proves this. No, it doesn't. So, you know, there's always the difficulty of once you step away from quantitative, directly, immediately measurable data around that is easily applied across population groups, you have a really hard time saying anything definitive. And unfortunately, when it comes to psych and sociology, you're almost never dealing with quantitative data. And even the tools that are used, some of them are great and they try to, there's always pieces missing. And so, you know, any quantitative studies in psych, as far as I'm concerned, are great as a starting ground, but they are not the final say on anything. I'm sure any number of, you know, post-PhD people are screaming at me right now. But yeah, I'm highly critical of my own field. So there's that. A lot of the studies involve abortion due to fetal abnormalities. So we're not looking necessarily at abortion by choice or an elective medical procedure. So that already now is like anything you have to say, conclusion wise, based on those, is now going to be a bit of a problem, because you're not actually dealing with a sizable percentage of the abortions that occur. In fact, making it even more crazy is that variations in consequences that people feel will shift depending on the form that the abortion procedure took. Literally, surgery will result in often different reactions than, say, RU486 or another pill. Like, it just, there are different, for a variety of reasons, not only medical issues, but social acceptance, the amount of care that has to be taken. All of these things go into this whole process. And we will actually touch on some of those things and the social kind of ramifications, ripple effects, and influences on this. And of course, you know, we'll be talking a lot about grief. So do want to make a real quick point here that obviously this is already a touchy subject, that many people may have already. So actually, I'm going to apologize really quickly. Should probably made this statement right at the beginning, but making it now. But if you at any time you are feeling in any way negatively triggered by what's going on, like, it is totally fine to take a step back. Definitely fine to do that. You need to shut me off. For that matter, if you just don't even like the sound of my voice, you can turn me off. You can read the transcript later if you want. Regardless, truly, just be able to shut things down a little bit, take a step back, walk around a little bit, get your body moving, come back. It's totally a fine, seek the support, call up the, helpline, do anything besides necessarily going, I can churn through this. I'm a big believer in resilience and building these things in dealing with adversity up to the point of where it is actually negatively impacting. So just want to, pause for a moment to point that out.
Thank you for saying that, David. I think that's very important, and that we stress to those who are here watching, we're not pushing a particular opinion or whatever or conclusion here. You're presenting information. We understand the emotional intensity of this topic, and we're here to present information and facts so that you can process it in your own way. And very wise advice. Everybody needs to come to their own conclusions after the information's presented.
I will say that I will end this with three kind of helpful tips on navigating all of this. And as well, obviously I have an opinion. I don't shy from that. I'm not a big believer, even as a therapist, even in session going, you know what, I'm just a blank slate. No, I actually have, no, I have opinions. I'm not here to, particularly in my therapeutic role, which is not what I am doing here, but in a therapeutic role, it's not my position to foist my opinion on anybody, but I'm not going to lie and say I have no opinion on anything. Of course I do. I'm a human being, and I'm me. So not having an opinion just is anathema to my very existence. So, you know, it's just, you know, even when I probably shouldn't. So it's just one of those things that is there. And that being said, this topic in particular, you know, a note that in last week's presentation, a high, you know, state of criticism. So I'm always going, I really could have done better. And so taking this last week to get a little clearer on some thoughts was really helpful. And even that being said, all of this is going to be, in the end, I'm here to foment further discussion because I think this, there is no definitive point here. And so, and what I want actually is more discussion. If there is one caveat positive that I will throw out for what has happened with the Supreme Court, is that it has forced all of us to fuck up or shut up. And it is, I'm not necessarily agreeing with how it went about it, but it is something where we all now have to really be clear, or we should, about what our policies are, what we're supporting, how we think about a lot of these questions. And we can't just simply go, oh, I belong to this camp, and then leave it alone, as if that was the summation of all that is needed. So getting away from that kind of identity, you know, in the avoidance strategy is, yeah, no longer, at least in my opinion, helpful or needed or useful, because we now have to deal with real live things that are now being splashed all over the internet in the news around real struggles and how we're going to look at such things at, you know, just that run the panoply of medical issues around this and how it works in actual lived experience, which is, I think, what actually ended up happening in Kansas, which I will get to actually a little bit later. So
the point you make there about, yeah, that in this polarized world, we need to be able to discuss topics, even these difficult topics, with a respect and a dignity and not just come at it from a position of polarization and camps, as you rightly say. To be able to discuss topics properly is the best way to resolve things or perhaps help our society function more smoothly.
Yeah, I am a fervent believer in dialogue. I think it is the bedrock of small L liberal democracy and the only way we can actually move forward as a society. Anytime we delve into any form of authoritarianism, I don't care if I agree with you. It is not ultimately helpful. And I'd rather go through the trenches of difficulty and the incrementalism at times than to try to force things down, you know, happening, because ultimately that comes up to bite us in the ass. It just does. So, you know, this, and one, and that's another point around the politics of all of this, is that we all do need, this needs to be a national conversation again. And that's partly what got paused, I think. I actually do agree a bit with Ginsburg before and others who stated, you know, when Roe v. Wade first started, that it kind of put a Band-Aid over it and then glued it, thinking it would be fine. And it wasn't. Because unfortunately, when you rely on authoritarian structures in a democracy, eventually people you may not agree with get in control. So, you know, we have to make a, you know, concerted effort there. You know, there is, I love actually a comparison between, say, abortion and gay marriage. And the and the reality is that gay marriage in many ways occurred and now has, for all intents and purposes, social support, even amongst religious, you know, Republicans, is that there is still a, you know, latest polling was like 65% being okay with gay marriage. I mean, that, like, the switch That is a nearly 30%, 30 to 40% switch in opinions in the course of like 20 years. That's nuts. It's absolutely incredible as far as social change is concerned. And I think part of it was, it was incremental. You know, we had issues around, you know, I'm totally blanking. What's the pre-marriage? It was legalized. It was domestic partnerships. You know, you had, for that matter, you had Will and Grace, which I think is hilarious because the whole show was actually used as a way of showing the down. I think it was focused on the family that had a problem with it. It was Dobson saying that it was like the signal for the downfall of civilization. Yeah, well, you know.
I'm still waiting for that to happen.
Yeah, like, yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Oh, Dobson.
So, yeah, David, a lot of these things.
When you say so there's a distinct difference between when something is put into law and society actually accepting it or having a view that is more progressive. And so you're trying to draw this distinction here between the fact that society progresses along and that it's not necessarily represented by when a particular law is enacted or not.
Yep, pretty much. Yeah, I mean, try to thread the needle between laws are an example of social morality, while at the same time, laws are almost inherently more conservative. And I mean that in a broad sense of the term conservative, not a political party. More conservative than societies tend to be. And there's a whole lot more to be said there as far as technology and whatnot. That's a whole other topic.
You mentioned Kansas then as an example of that. So we have a society progressing to a point where the recent polling has shown very much where society stands with their view, and yet legally it needed to be a line needed to be drawn in the sand with it.
Yes. Yep. And in fact, so before I can touch on Kansas first, actually, I think, did everybody do the poll?
Yes.
Yes, if you want the results.
It's just going to be fun.
All right, share. All right, there you go.
Okay, that's unexpected.
Interesting. But for those who can't read the poll, we'll read that out. So the first question, have you had a personal experience, whether yourself or in relation to another, in connection to an abortion? We have 41% saying yes, 48% saying no, and 10% saying likely but not sure. David, can you speak to that?
That was surprising. So interesting. And here's a polling quote or point to consider. Always consider the population you're polling from. So there is no definitive statements to be made from this. My brain wants to, because that's what we do as a human species. But no. But it is interesting as far as who's listening in right now. And no, thank you for that, because that'll shift a little bit of what you talk about.
Interesting. And then the second one was, do you consider abortion to be purely a religious question? 10% said yes, 79% said no. Very interesting.
That is interesting.
Also surprising. Well, all right.
Third question, is the social question of abortion tied directly to issues of socially prescribed sex roles? 45% said yes, 7% said no, 10% said the binary here is obnoxious, interesting, and then 38% said, seriously, how could this not be related? So
I love it.
Yeah.
We'll lump yes in the last one really together.
I think so. Interesting. And you're right. We're drawing upon perhaps an audience here, a smaller number of, it's not necessarily reflective of society, and also an audience that's made their way to an RFR presentation. So does that skew the results in some way?
Of course it does. Yeah. Yeah. And at the same time, it's always fascinating. So
yeah,
this is one of those things where I'm practically a free speech purist. Because if for no other reason, then I like to know what people actually think. I want you to feel like you can say anything, because then I know who I'm dealing with.
That's how I feel. I'm like, oh, you're not on my team. Okay, yeah, now I know. That's how I feel. So, you know. Yeah.
So if we extrapolate that out, or if we extend that out, we talked a little bit about Kansas and the results there. That's obviously a poll taken on a much, much bigger demographic of people, or numbers of people. How do the results that have come through with the recent poll there reflect when you look at things on a national scale?
Yeah, so it's interesting with Kansas, and there's actually a quote an article that just recently, like 2 days ago, came out that I think I gave it in the resources. If not, I can share it as well. Mm-hmm. But it really well done as far as like literal interviewing people and so on the ground. But there is one quote in particular. Everybody in America thinks Kansas is so conservative, but Kansas is pretty staunchly anti-government. And that was from Ali Scholes, who's an emergency medicine doctor. And I have no problem saying the name because literally it's out there. So the key point here is wanting to be very, very careful about noting Kansas's vote as simply being okay with abortion rights per se, so much as looking at, you know, a lot of things that were going on. Part of it, the law was really poorly written. Part of it was, I think, judicial overreach. But as well, there is this thing about being, you know, stating that, you know, the whole between you and your, you know, between you and your doctor thing. You know, there's a reason why it was a big selling point behind everything related to the Affordable Care Act, or otherwise known as Obamacare. You know, it was like, oh, there's going to be a, you know, the government's going to get between you and your doctor and all these choices, which is hilarious. The conservatives were saying it then, and now it's actually what they want. But anyway, here and there. But that's just it. I mean, people gravitate towards, they want, and so much of this is going to, and we'll see continually over and over and over and over again, is this tension between autonomy and freedom, or autonomy and authority, and what that looks like in practice. And people contain multitudes. Let's kind of put it that way. We have a lot of stories around how we consider ourselves in relation to societal influences. How we consider ourselves in relation to even our own ideas, you know, issues of free will, autonomy, how this works, or, you know, how we relate to government. And
peer pressure has a
barrier. Peer pressure, totally. You know, I mean, you know, I'm always struck by the people who are like, I don't care. I don't know why, you know, politicians spend so much money on polling, you know, on advertising. That doesn't influence anybody.
Oh, okay.
Really?
All right.
Really? No, it does. And the key thing in that particular example is that it doesn't. We define a lot of this often by starting with as if there is this 0 to 1 only. There's nothing in between. Mm-hmm. So a influence must be nothing or everything, and that is never how this works. All you need to do is be able to tweak and influence percentages. There is an infinity between 0 and 1 that can be done in order to curb just right, or in the right circumstances, to get you into a certain mindset that'll make certain choices more amenable. I mean, we all know this, actually, just at a very basic level. We can, you know, come across an ad around our favorite candy bar, and, you know, Butterfinger all the way, and, you know, and go, you know, yeah, I was like, no. Fixing my teeth. And like that. Yeah.
I'm judging.
And so, you know, it's like, you know, and we'll say no to it, no big deal. And then suddenly some other day we'll be coming across it. And it's like, I must have it. Why? I mean, there's just any number of influences that, depending on the context, are going to push us one way or another. It's why you know, political polling is so notoriously difficult because you'll literally have the same people answer differently depending on. And I love the fact that right now there's an entire commentary around who's favorite candy bar.
Yeah, look what you started. All.
Everybody's got a polarized world.
Yeah. Come here for my presentations. Stay for the Nutrageous.
It's like, a Kit Kat, y'all. It's Kit Kat. Yeah. I don't know what y'all talk about in the chat. It's a Kit Kat.
How will we ever be united when we can't decide on the candy bars?
So it's difficult to see how that works. Go ahead.
Yeah, let me ask you a serious question then on that line, David. So we talk about people being influenced by society change, progressive change, perhaps peer pressure, just the progression of how people think. That's not necessarily a bad thing, because obviously society has progressed dramatically in so many topics. We think of things that were acceptable 100 years ago that we absolutely do not accept now in society. Slavery, whatever, we don't want to, misogyny, you know, we have progressed as a society, and that's as a result of the forward momentum of positive peer pressure. What about topics such as these currently divisive topics of abortion rights or bodily autonomy? It's actually a good thing for progress to happen, right?
I absolutely do. And I say that with a very, 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 very strong caveat of people are hurt in the process. Mm-hmm. Like simply cannot capture, you know, the number of lives that are going to be changed, damaged, destroyed, like harmed by any number of these as we figure things out societally. And that is also true through all of human history. It would be great if we just had a download new software and boom, everybody is on target with the latest and greatest of, you know, ethical considerations. We don't have that. It's really, really tricky. And, you know, and we have this, especially in a country this large and this non-homogeneous, we have literally state to state variations. I mean, the fact that we still have 14 states that have anti-sodomy laws on the books. Now, granted, none of them are capable of legally being, implemented or used against people, but it doesn't mean that they can't be brought up by people who want to harass others. So I mean, we still have that going on. I mean, legal issues around butt sex. What the hell? Anyway, you know, it's like, so, you know, we have these things that are a lot of nuances depending on where you're at. And it is astounding at times how fast we are capable of changing and how fast we are capable of making progress on stuff that, had you asked anybody even a few years previous, to be like, you're out of your freaking mind that we're going to have that. I mean, it's just, there's just no way people would have considered fill in the blank of the last 200 years of this country's history. Like, it just, we have gone so fast and we are moving ever quicker through things that we have no idea where it's all going to land. And in fact, that actually exacerbates much of what is happening, is we are moving so fast that our little, you know, prehistoric brains are not really good at navigating it. Because if we consider the fact that, and this actually goes back a little bit to the comment around, you know, triggering and how this works, we can consider stress as a mental labeling of how we physiologically deal with change. And by change, I do mean literally any change. So I work with a lot of clients on transition spaces. And by transition, I do mean literally anything like moving from one room to the next, like putting on, you know, your clothes in the morning to, you know, to the bigger ones, like going from home to work, and how this all works in practice. But transition spaces are where stress exists. It's where things are happening. Mm-hmm. Sometimes we feel it. It rises to the level of conscious awareness because it's a big deal. Most of the time, like, yeah, no big deal. you know, just kind of deal with it and move on. And I'm totally going to have to go back through and look at all
the people.
Can I go
Sorry,
ahead?
Helen? No, yeah, Helen, please.
So do you think like what you're saying about like stress in these transition periods, like the minor stresses that we deal with, you know, with like work and family conflict and single, those are like stresses that we can identify, and certain stresses you just kind of know. It's like a part of the routine. Or like big societal changes, like, you know, Roe v. Wade, or things like that, it affects people different because one, it's very an emotional reaction because it is not just affecting one structure, one family structure, is affecting the populace as a whole. And us being part of a society, we're going to think about it on a societal level, which is sometimes a little bit hard for our brains to wrap around how like this is going to affect everyone in that nuanced way, where like those little stresses are just easier for us to deal with because we're just kind of used to them. So, you know, and I think that our little, you know, evolutionary, you know, reactive brain, you know, what goes into fight or flight, you know, doesn't know how to really sit down and process it when it gets to such a large scale on that level.
Yeah. Well, and we know this precisely because of how we react to overly to small events that happen in our personal lives. And we have a really hard time wrapping our heads around national tragedies that happen a world away. Like we might feel it. We might go, wow, that's tricky. You know, some of us who have really exercised our empathy muscle, you know, might have a, you know, larger reaction, but by and large, we move on. I mean, if a, you know, for that matter, you know, the COVID going on, it's still happening. One, it's probably never going to go away completely. But, you know, literally over a million extra, like more than the average deaths have occurred in this last couple of years. And we still have the vast majority of people going, you know, so, why? Because if it's not personally felt, our brains don't do really well with large numbers. And this is, and this will lead back to, we are actually talking about the abortion thing. I'm going to bring it back here in just a second. But, you know, looking at big numbers, looking at big concepts, we're not really good at dealing with that. We have to, at some level, get to the nitty gritty of the individual experiences and how you actually deal with some of these, you know, difficult situations, because otherwise you never actually deal with the realities of what it is to be in the flesh, to actually deal with how we interact with one another.
So David, does that tie in with the psychology of being humans? We, unless it affects us personally, we glaze over, or we forget, or we have a saturation point, or complacency as well. You were talking about the progression of society, perhaps even legally, but unless we catch up individually as members of society, can we also get to a point of complacency with some of these big social issues and topics and feel like, well, we've solved that, we've moved from that, and therefore what's happened now with the overturning through SCOTUS, it's come as a shock because we've all thought we've dealt with this, we've progressed, and now we feel like we're two steps backwards. Is that part of this whole thing where humans go to a point where we think that's over with, we don't need to worry about it anymore, and yet problems still exist in the social consciousness of or individuals?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. And this is true of, you know, we innately gravitate towards echo chambers, you know, and one, they're safe. Two, we really don't like being challenged. And part of that is that because of the way we view the world, it's not just an idea. Our worldviews are not just simply platitudes and stuff that we say in order to piss people off, unless you're on Twitter, then you totally do that. But otherwise,
Twitter's successful.
Yeah, it is.
Twitter's
I have an intense love-hate relationship with Twitter. And
you can move across to Truth Social.
Oh, yeah, there's that. Truth.
So it's not just, you know, words we're using. It's literally a way of looking at how we relate to and believe the world functions. So when we think of ourselves as being wrong, it's not just like, oh, I might be wrong. No, it's literally like, oh my God, the way the world works does not work the way I thought it did. I talk about increasing anxiety. Like this is so, in which is one reason why, you know, in fact, one big point about why I try to keep in context of literally any time that I work with, whether it's with a client or anybody else, anytime you're challenging, you're never just challenging the words. You are challenging the structure of the person's universe, at least in that particular moment. And there is a good piece there to keep in mind when people start getting incensed, ourselves included, around a topic, is to go, oh, okay, no, I'm having a reaction. It's not inherently wrong or right. It just is. And the reason for it is because how I view the world and how I think it should or does work is being violated. And so we're going to have a reaction to it. I mean, this is about survival. You know, our brains didn't evolve to figure out logic and truth with a capital T. They evolved in order to figure out how to make sense in such a way as to get us living just far enough to continue our species. That's it. We really don't care about truth. If it cared about truth, we'd have evolved a long time ago not to be tricked by mirages, but we are all the damn time. So the brains are not really caring too much about this concept. The fact that we can consider these things, the fact that we can, you know, delve into philosophy and so on, frankly, it's just a testament, I think, to the amazing quality of just our biology. And it's a wonderful thing. But we never should forget that we are fundamentally a middle of the world, middle earth, kind of like, you know, feeling creature that is interested fundamentally in, you know, promoting the continuation of our flesh. And everything else is kind of superfluous.
So if we tie this back to the religion, the abortion thing, I think that also too, and correct me if I'm wrong, because not only is this like a fear reaction, but it also ties into like this, the thing about our species that we procreate. We want to continue forth the line, as they say. And for a lot of people, it's like, I'm a parent, you know, and other parents that I've talked to, the idea of like something happening to a baby, like this precious thing that we consider, is can be overwhelming. So I think that for people that are, you know, are pro-child and don't really think abortion is bad because they literally think that you're killing a child. And so getting into that conversation with them about like nuances and, you know, viability and all these different things, they don't, it's a hard thing to break through because they, in their brain, they're like, you are killing a child. It's not a lump of cells. You know, we're us on the other side are like, I understand that, but we want people to have bodily autonomy. And that's where that nuance kind of gets lost, especially because this particular topic is so emotional and it on both sides creates that fear response.
Well, and it's a good juxtaposition there between, you know, the autonomy on one hand and life on the other, because one, both sides care about both. You know, this is not, you know, it's one of the fundamental things behind the APA's task force was noting that, you know, women who proceeded with an unwanted pregnancy also subsequently had more physical health problems, including two who died from childbirth complications. They faced more economic hardships, including worse credit scores, frequent bankruptcies, evictions, higher chance of living in poverty. You know, after being denied an abortion, women were also more likely to stay linked to a violent partner or to raise children alone. I mean, children born as a result of abortion denial were not only more likely to live in poverty, but they were also more likely to experience poor bonding with their own mothers. Mm-hmm. I mean, this is this is never the case of simply like, oh, I, you know, do or don't care about, you know, life or about choice. It is always about, instead, at what point are you making that decision and who gets to decide, period. You know, this is the question, and this is why I don't avoid questions around, say, for instance, viability in life, precisely because it inserts a nuance to the discussion that I think, one, is needed in order to help break apart these like binary choices that most people are having. But two, I don't want people who are more religiously minded in applying their religious epistemologies to that question. Like, I don't want to concede, you know, issues around, you know, what is life and how does this begin, which I think is a derivation of it. But it's further, like, as technology continues to happen, like, we're going to be pondering these questions as we literally go on to other planets. I mean, we're going to be, one, we're searching for it, but two, say we go to Mars, say we go, we figure out faster than light travel. Oh, that'd be awesome. Probably not in my lifetime, but I can geek out and hope. You know, it's like, we ever figure this out, we go to another planet. One, having the question about what do we consider life to be? Does it have to be carbon-based? How does this, you know, how does this all work? And then further, if I were to do X on this new world, how is this going to possibly, hey, say, wipe out an entire species because I didn't bother asking how does their world start? How do these things function? And so, I mean, these are going to be questions that we're going to need to, at some point, maybe not necessarily in any of our lifetimes, but eventually. And it's a good thing to, you know, take stock of and going, huh, the last thing I want is for these questions to be at the mercy of, you know, a 2,000-year-old, storybook. You know, that's not who I want to be in charge of. You know, further, it comes back to the flesh experience of being a mother, of going through and being pregnant, and going through and feeling like all of the variations of how pregnancy occurred, both in the wanted form and the all too insanely unwanted, you know, number too often occasions, the unwanted form. You know, it's like, the fact that, you know, and so, in fact, here, before I get off on my own little tirade, you know, one thing here from one article on, and I'll post this later, is from Social Sources of Women's Emotional Difficulty After Abortion. Two social aspects of the abortion experience produced, exacerbated, or mitigated respondents' negative emotional experience. And those were, negative outcomes were experienced when the woman did not feel that the abortion was primarily her decision, or did not feel that she had clear emotional support after. At no point in any of the studies that have so far gone, and again, I will throw out the caveat that there's still a lot more still to be studied, but at no point in any of this happened, any of the things that I've read, both in, as well, the APA's task force, it is never the act itself, in the act being abortion, that incurs a specific and necessary emotional traumatic response. Just isn't. It's not the act itself. It is everything surrounding it. It is one's personal, you know, ideology when it comes to it. You know, there's one paper that I actually found the direct link to, so anybody can download and read it. It's excellent. Well worth reading. Around you know, the roles of one's notions of religion, free will, autonomy, how these ideas actually inform how a woman will consider the act previously and then how they may consider it afterward. So ideas matter. It is never the act itself that is, it's that by its own is, you know, some kind of incurring a particular response. So
that's powerful. So can you put the link to that study there? So it is not the act itself, it is everything else external around that person, the society, the judgment, the background, the indoctrination, the trauma that will contribute to how they feel about it.
Always. It always plays a role. You know, so, you know, in some ways it's similar to how do we know the efficacy behind, say, talk therapy, is that it's very rarely having to do with the techniques that are used. It is almost predominantly concerned with the relationship bond between the therapist and the client.
Yeah.
Like you have a shitty bond, not going to have great outcomes. You know, it's just the way it is. It's why I always make a big deal out of, look, if we're not, if the rapport isn't there, you have a problem with me, something I said, by all means, I'm not going to take it personally, that you're going to find somebody to that you're better able to bond with. Because that's where the success, by and large, not that there aren't terrible therapy techniques out there, but by and large, that is what is going to show support and progress, because we are inherently social creatures. We just, the bone deep. It does not matter if you refer to yourself as an extrovert or introvert. It is, we are at core social creatures. And so, you know, we live and die and make our meaning through how we relate to and with and within our social bonds. And when it comes to species questions around something so fundamental as procreation, you know, it's a little wonder that issues around sexuality as well are massively blown up for a lot of good reason. Is because we're not just talking about who's got a favorite, you know, car manufacturer. I mean, we're literally talking about things that go to the heart of what it means to be a human being in, you know, in the processes that allow us to, you know, continue on with our lives. That is not anything that is just going to be, you know, coldly logical. Not that I like that affectation applied to logic, but anyway, you know, it's never going to go there.
So how can we, sorry, Helen?
How do we, so for those of us in our like layman lives, because we're going to have these really difficult conversations, which, like you said, it's a good thing to have difficult conversations, but it is now, because this particular issue is now at the forefront of everybody's mind, how do we go about having this difficult conversation on the topic of abortion and not alienate the person that might be on the opposite end that you are? Because I know that I am an opinionated, emotional person, but also at the same time, I want to recognize the person that thinks opposite of me as a human being, and how they came to conclusions is valid to them, as how I came to my conclusions are valid to me. So we have to find a way to bridge the gap. So how would you suggest that we bridge that gap?
And that's where we get into shared humanity and actually shared values. And that is, so from one, in fact, the article that had to do with conflicts between women's religiosity and sense of free will in the context of elective abortion, which is by and large often where the sticky point in social policy comes in, is that the participants were ambivalent because they expressed relief while simultaneously experiencing the termination of the pregnancy as a loss that elicited negative feelings of grief. However, despite their suffering, the participants' respective abortions led to eventual increased self-awareness. Okay? Thus, this ambivalence can be regarded as not only problematic, but also indicative of an openness to the complexity of abortion issue from a moral point of view. You know, so, you know, invoked, you know, a lot of invocation principles around self-determination, you know, linking it to, you know, how they refer to it, you know, in their freedom. You know, this is, so much of this is going to be around, you know, the support level that each person has at every stage of this process. And that begins with listening, and hearing where people are coming from, and which is, you know, and actually bringing up, there are nuances. You know, I often throw out, you know, I hear the whole thing, well, 65 to 70% of the public didn't want Roe v. Wade to be overturned. Yes and no. You know, it's true if you ask that question purely at that way. But when you start getting into, well, are you okay with the government stepping in to stop this? Actually, that's a little higher. Are you okay with the government stopping it at the first trimester, second, third? Well, now all of a sudden, the numbers are all over the freaking map. And they are a whole lot lower than that 70% the further along the pregnancy you go. Now, does that mean that everybody has a definitive answer on this? Actually, no. Because if you ask even more questions and try to get in the the nitty-gritty of how this actually works, they start throwing up all sorts of contradictory answers. Like, it just, in part of that, I think, is because we've had decades where people haven't had to think about it. They just said, I'm with this party and I'm with this party. And we had no conversations around how this was actually going to work in practice. And so people didn't need to wrestle with it. And now they are. And as a consequence, you've got a whole bunch of just crazy opinions and that are at the behest of, on one hand, it's a great thing that we have the technology that we now have now than when we did it when Roe v. Wade was decided. Because we have the capacity now to spread information and stories and the lived experience of women everywhere fast. Like, we know what people are going through at the drop of a hat. On the other hand, we have, of course, all of the issues that are associated with social media and the spread of a whole bunch of, you know, crazy, you know, loudest voice gets the most attention. So, you know, how this is all going to pan out, I have no idea. I will note one thing here of the link to Valerie Tirico, who is just one of the most fabulous people I've ever had the absolute privilege of meeting. She wrote an article a while back about being not just simply pro-choice, but pro-abortion. And she has actually 10 points, you know, of why. And I'm not going to say I necessarily agree with every last little nuanced piece of it. Then again, I don't agree with everything I think. So, you know, it is what it is. But there was a thing here on those who see abortion as an unmitigated evil often talk about the millions of missing people who were not born into this world because a pregnant woman decided not now. But they never talk about the millions of children and adults who are here today only because their mothers had abortions. Real people who exist in this version of the future, people who are living out their lives all around us, loving and laughing and suffering and struggling and dancing and dreaming and having babies of their own. And which is very rarely, you know, this is where I go immediately to the initial part of it's like, oh, if you have your babies, don't worry, I'll adopt them. But literally, I know you're lying because there are millions of children who are still squandering in orphanages and everything out there. Like, you are lying, period.
Yeah.
Like, I have no qualms calling that out. It is the most ridiculous rejoinder I've ever heard, because we only have to point to the continued existence of children in orphanages. Like,
and stuck that's in the foster care system. And
it is.
Yeah.
And so this is not going to be solved by those kinds of empty platitudes. And in recognizing the real experiences of so many people that are not only, you know, it's the same kind of rejoinder of like, well, this baby could have cured cancer. Yeah, and this one could have been the next Pol Pot. I mean, let's consider.
It's a false equivalency because, you know, because we can't say that this child is going to grow up to be like the next Ted Bundy or grow up to be, you know, the person that cures cancer. It's a null argument to have,
yep.
You exactly. know, because it's like, okay, fine, good, all right, great, that could have happened, you know. But what we're, and I think that the frustration comes from, we're having this rhetoric about, we're debating things like that, like, you know, these little like emotional arguments about, you know, nuances and things like that, which is frustrating for, you know, and I can say this as someone that is pro-abortion and pro-choice, that I don't want to have that argument. I want, because the person I'm having the argument with, if they have a daughter or some of the uterus that is pushed up against the wall and needs to have an abortion, I want them to do it safely, mm-hmm. And with respect and with emotional support, so they can have their best life, because this is the life that they're living now. All those potential lives aren't in this fucking world, man. So let's deal with the people that are here now. Thank you very much.
And it's exactly those potential lives and how we relate to them. Because even if you're pro-choice, you are still relating to that potential in one way or another. Mm-hmm. And so getting clear as possible, because I'm going to say it again, and probably said it 100 times already. None of this is a definitive, like I have all the answers out here. This is an evolving thing. If you'd asked me 10 years ago, I would have given you one, you know, answer. If you'd asked me 6 months ago, I probably would have given you some, you know, maybe a little bit closer to where I am now, but still would have been different. I've already shifted a little bit, and I've shifted in the process of bigger freaking question marks. It just is so tricky to start really navigating a lot of these things, which is again why, and I'll go to the helpful tips because I think we're timing around. And that is, one, emotions are often, if not always, an initial assessment of perceived change. Like anytime we have an emotional reaction, it's because, wow, something just shifted from some nebulous point A to point B. And now I have this knee-jerk response to it. And whether or not it's something that happened in support of what I wanted, oh, positive. Or it's something that I didn't want to happen, negative. You know, which can change, of course, based on the number of factors, including time. You know, so some of the studies that I already quoted before, you know, it's like you have grief. And then later on, you have greater self-awareness and acceptance. So a lot of this goes into how, you know, our emotional experiences do not have an immediate and necessary connection to any, you know, ethical or, necessary behavioral outlet. Like they just exist as initial assessments of what's going on. So you'll often hear, like, for instance, I could go back to that one about the grief. And I've heard it actually, because grew up fundamentalist. I almost went to Moody Bible Institute, really wanted to go. That would have been a different life. Anyway, you know, it's just like, you know, this is a variation here in going, well, let's see if we can nitpick and stop right in the sentence in the middle there. See, women experience grief. And if you just stop there, then you've made a point. If you go to the rest of it, now you've made a separate one. Is it as clear? No. Is it more helpful? Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. And so being aware of in all of these situations, like not judging regardless of who it is, but particularly, you know, the, you know, women who are going through this process of deciding, going through pregnancy, going through all of it, at no point should any of us be judging any of them in a single point of reference, period. I have talked with women before who started off on one hand and went all the way to the other and vice versa. And if we were to have stopped the conversation at any single point along the road, would have been a disservice to them.
So you're saying we can progress and we can evolve and we we're not stuck in a particular moment in time or thinking.
Thankfully. Otherwise, yeah, shoot. I'd still want to be a baggage handler at the grocery store. So because that's really what I wanted to do when I was 10. I'm like, no. I mean, this is not. No, we thankfully progress. I mean, that's why we're not, still throwing up drawings on cave walls. Instead, we do it on our skin and on the internet, the modern day cave walls. I mean, it's just like we progress not only individually, we progress societally, and sometimes it is really nasty to go through, and other times it's shocking, and another time it's amazing. And what is happening societally is happening individually. And if we're going to allow for the larger piece to evolve and get better, we need to be able to take a look even internally in ourselves and go, how often have our own ideas shift and evolve? I mean, I'm literally talking to a group who by and large used to believe in variations of deities. And maybe some still do. And yet even then, there's been an evolution. I mean, really, read the article from Kansas in particular. Most of the quotes there are from religious leaders who are saying they are pro-choice. Evangelical leaders, believers. This is why I don't present this purely as a religious question, because one, religious doesn't really tell me anything about you. it really doesn't. Any more than I get the question of like, do you believe in God? And I always ask, which one? Yeah. Why? Because the term is meaningless until you start filling it in. And I am much more interested in how you use it to interpret your world and how you want to act in it than I am at all interested in what kind of dogma you're going to spout at me. Because at the end of the day, you're going to align with the complexity and the cognitive dissonance that is the heart of being human far more than whether or not you believe in, the Bible, as if there's only one, or the Pope or whatever religious leader or tradition or anything. Like, you can spout that all day long until you actually get to the nitty gritty of what's happening. I'm just going to go, that's nice. Thank you for letting me know. And can we get to the real stuff here? Because this actually is where it matters. And that's where we get into the emotions again, is recognizing that as we work through this, not stopping at any point and saying, oh, now I get to define who you are because of this particular reaction. No, I don't want that for me. It's certainly, I'm not going to try applying it to anybody else either. And that's where the second, keep the conversation flowing. We have the greater degree we avoid authoritarianism and fundamentalist judgments. The more we engage in steel manning or in the latest thing from FAIR, about star manning. Love the concept. It's not just the best argument. It's also the best argument combined with the love of the shared humanity you have. Because that's where people are going to respond best to. Totally an illusion to we are star stuff. I love it. It is. And then, of course, support does not mean acquiescence. In the sense that you can support even people you disagree with as they struggle through, some of what's going on without necessarily going, I agree with everything you stand for right now. I mean, this is fundamentally one of those things that, particularly as a therapist, you have to run into all the time. I don't agree with everything my clients do. Like, that'd be absurd. At the same time, there is a functionality to the role and to the relationship that is about support. And it's not that we all need to become therapists. I wouldn't wish that on anybody necessarily. Like, it really... If I can still maintain the notion of calling for my religious upbringing, I swear that applies to anything you're going to do, like social work and so on. You have to really want it. And be slightly masochistic. It's not that everybody needs to do this, embody that completely. It's just a little piece of going, you're struggling, and I'm going to support the space for the continuation of that struggle. because as soon as I make it impossible for you to shift and mold and maybe even be contradictory, then I cut off the capacity for you to change.
Well, and that makes sense, because I think that a lot of people, you know, they can hold, you know, those contradictory views in their brain, because I do it, you know, all the time. But it's just the idea of opening the person up to examining and asking questions about those things that they're holding in their brain. So on that note, would you like to answer some questions?
Absolutely.
All right. Absolutely. Sasha, do you want to take the first one and we'll switch swap.
Now, we don't have a lot of time, so we'll try and move through these fairly quickly with you, David, if that's all right. But these are questions that have been put to us from the chat or directly. Do you feel that women with trauma associated with abortion are more religious than the ones not experiencing trauma after?
So far, from what I've gathered, there is no difference, not in a definitive way. Because what ends up happening is that it's not the religious ideology per se, it's the social grouping that tends to be a result of. And it's that support or lack thereof that tends to then contribute to, not in a one-to-one, you know, ratio, but it contributes to or influences the degree to which they, you know, are able to move through both the initial decision, but then the after effects later. Because let's face the fact that regardless of, even if you are, say, 100% like pro-choice, this is not an ethical issue, there's little concerns, you know, what's going on, afterwards you've got total social support, you have still fundamentally altered your body. And I mean that in the most objective way possible. You've fundamentally altered what was going on biologically. Internally speaking, that is going to result in a lot of just disruptions. It just is. And I'm not putting an ethical judgment on it. I'm not putting any kind of judgment. It just is. And this is, we talk about concepts like hangry. I mean, if we can get angry over the fact we haven't had a Snickers bar in a while, I love those commercials, but if we haven't had that, like, you know, and now I've restarted the whole Kenny bar debate again, but I mean, it's like, if we can get angry just from that, the shift hormonally in bio, like all of it that has occurred in the ending of pregnancy, this is not going to be a simple thing to just walk through. And so allowing for that space, all the more in the support is what's needed.
So on that note, I'm glad you said that. The next question was, because it tied in directly, do any abortion providers like Planned Parenthood or women's clinics provide mental health care after referrals, not just the physical health care, but mental health care?
From what I gather, and do not take my word for this, because that is actually something I now need to get a better, clearer example or idea of, not very much. In fact, almost all the recommendations I saw from the APA and, you know, plenty of the other studies is that it's an encouragement to clinics and so on to provide support and mental health care afterwards, regardless. And in fact, one of the indicators to note that there will be some greater difficulty emotionally after is the degree to which the woman is filled with self-judgment ahead of time. If they're highly self-critical, that tendency, just like, you know, if we're prone to depression or prone to any number of things, will latch on to any change in the environment internally or otherwise. So, you know, so knowing that, it's a way of going, ooh, okay, we've assessed this. Here's somebody who's, you know, highly critical. Probably we should, you know, make sure even more so and connect them with, even if it's, you know, for a short time, like at least having that space in a non-judgmental, supportive, you know, supportive space is hugely helpful. And so anytime we can do that, you know, some organizations do it better than others, but I don't think it's actually a very universal thing. And that's really unfortunate.
Yeah, it is. Because we all know that we need more mental health care. Definitely.
Yes.
Yeah. You know, not just on this type, but just in general. Like, I think everybody should have a therapist. Everybody.
Yeah.
Anyway, so I'm going to move on to another topic, another mental health topic. So since change assumes loss and then grief, no matter how small, what are the various causes of grief with the abortion arena?
Cool. Yeah.
This is a very light and easy question.
Yeah. I mean, if I'm understanding the question right, and whoever said it, by all means, you know, respond if I'm not touching on it correctly. But that has to do with, I touched on it a little bit there at the end in one of the last questions, and that is the changes that we're making to just bodies when you're going through this. And there is a loss. There's a loss of potential. Well, we talk about potential life, but we also, you know, and this is the thing, like most women who are having an abortion often already have kids. Or often then go on to have one. So this is not the caricature of it's simply another form of birth control. Yes, there are some that have used it as such. I'm much, frankly, more interested in the majority. And so you have women who have, like, they viscerally know what it is to look forward to all of the experiences that they're going to have with this child. Hence, and I quoted this earlier, around those who are, are forced into or have had their abortion denied and have the kid, the pair bond between the mother and the child is often less.
Timing wasn't right. Yeah.
I mean, like, well, of course. So because at that point, now you're looking at loss as well, because your loss of all of the stories you did have that now weren't because you were forced into the situation. You now have the loss of everything that you could have done beforehand, and so on. I mean, this loss is not this like one-way street. You only feel it one way. Like, this is, it's absurd. So any time that there is a shift in the projected hope or plan and the reality, we're going to experience loss and grief in various ways. And so this is fundamental to all of this all of its context.
This is weighing up which loss is more important at that particular point in time for the person.
And
it's timing. I am not going to put a number on this and go, your grief is worse than you. I'm not playing that game.
Comes out to the individual to decide what's best for them.
And I can say, yeah, as a parent, even though I wanted my children, I still mourned things that I lost that I wasn't able to do because I decided to have children. So it's not even black or white that way either, because you can still want a child and choose to do it and still mourn the things and, you know, wonder, like, what if I decided not to have a kid? What if I had, you know, lived my life kid free or waited longer or whatever, you know? I mean, like, I can remember I got pregnant with my son right around this time when I was finishing some secondary some college level education. I was hoping to enter a field. Didn't get to do that. I was pregnant and decided to have my son. And like, and I'm glad I have him because we're very close and I love him to death. But there's a part of me that was like, when I found out I was pregnant, I was angry. I was frustrated because I was like, fuck. I found out like 2 days before I graduated that I was pregnant. So, you know, and so there is not just black and white, like, you know, you choose not to have kids or you choose to have kids, you know, and everything is hunky-dory based on that decision, because it's not. Mm-hmm. It's always nuanced and complicated, because that's just the way we are.
And it will change throughout your life.
Yeah.
It just is. I mean, even from the, male perspective, at least my biological male's perspective, I mean, it's like I had a vasectomy when I was 25, which is the actual minimum age. Mm-hmm. And the surgeon actually had, was like, you're going to meet a woman, it's going to change your mind, blah, blah. And I literally I wrote a letter. Like, it was a one page philosophical point by point letter as to this is why I'm not going to have children, biologically, and so on. I got a phone call the next day and surgery happened. Never think that it's that easy. It hurts like hell, but anyway, totally another thing. But it's like, but even since then, like, do I look back more years than I care to count? Since that happened, to say that I am 100%, in favor of that original decision, no. Am I still comfortable with having made the decision? Yeah. But to say that I don't at times, in my own way, wrestle with, what could have been? Mm-hmm. How would I have been a father? How would I have done this? And that also opens up, there's issues of adoption and everything. Like, I eschewed all of those options. And so, but there's always that question. And that's from, here, where I wouldn't actually be like building it within my own body. I can't even, I can't actually, I can come like, maybe close, but there's just no way. And yet at the same time, the notion of loss, the notion of wrestling with potential, is still something that can, in my own way, touch on. And I think all of us can. And even if it isn't exactly the same degree, I'm not even going to discuss degrees. It's not the point. The point is that you have the capacity to regret, to challenge yourself, to wonder, to ask about potential, means that there is something to then empathically bond with whoever is going through this as this is not a simple thing. So,
but when you say that, David, you're respecting the decision that you made at a different point in time. Mm-hmm. Without that does not discount the fact that things may change or people's views may change. It's respecting your own choice, respecting other people's choices that are made at a specific point in time. And that doesn't then dictate what that choice has to be for the rest of time either. It's just basic personal respect, as it is for respect to other people in society.
Right. Yeah.
Right. We have time for one more question, because we are running a little bit over, which is fine, mm-hmm. because this is a really good topic. And especially with this topic, it is not a like really quick thing that you just hit some points and then you're done. It's a very complex and nuanced conversation. So we're going to, Sasha, do you want to take the last question before we start wrapping things up at this talk? And thank you, David, because this is a complicated thing. So we really do appreciate going into those finer points, because it's not easy.
Yeah, thanks, David. So a bit of an amalgamated question. So in a nutshell, what is the key for society or for a community to progress in a respectful way, a dignified way? And how do we engage with people who don't necessarily reflect a position that we might fall on?
I actually think I gave an entire presentation on this a while back. So consult the RFR library. In a nutshell, so much of this is about finding I'm going to come back to that Star Manning, point. It's not just about figuring out the best form of an argument that is contrary to you. And I think the important thing to consider there is, because there's more to it than that, precisely because we are more than just an argument. We are a living, breathing flesh bag of contradictory things in a world that is constantly pulling us in a thousand different directions. And so we need to do more than just simply come up with and understand each other's arguments. We also have to be able to look at each person in the eye and go, yeah, welcome to humanity and all of the messiness. And I'm reminded of, I think it was, you know, the philosopher Goethe, you know, like, there but for the grace of God go I. And if you want to, you know, replace God there with chance, go run on that. I think it's essentially the same thing. You know, it's really, it's like there but for a thousand variations that I had no control over, I'd be in that position or something similar. And if that doesn't inspire a certain level of humility and ability to reflect on this person who is in a different place than you are, then I don't know what does. But that's how we move forward.
Brilliant. That's a good point. And nice way to round it. Absolutely appreciate it.
Recovering from Religion is a nonprofit organization whose mission it is to provide hope, healing, and support to those struggling with issues of doubt and non-belief. Hope, healing, and support is waiting for you on our website, recoveringfromreligion.org. There you can speak or chat with a trained agent who will work with you through your struggles and doubts or to help find resources that may work for you. You can also find local Recovering from Religion support groups in your area for the long-term recovery work. Resources specifically curated for those struggling with doubts, disbelief, and trauma can also be found on the RFR website. To connect with a secular therapist in your area, go to seculartherapy.org and create an account. If you'd like to support the work that RFR does, you can donate or sign up as a volunteer on the Recovering from Religion website. It's also a big help subscribing to the RFR YouTube channel, our blog, or following us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. Questions, comments, and suggestions can be emailed to us at rfrx@recoveringfromreligion.org. Thanks for tuning in, and we hope you'll be with us next time on the Recovering from Religion podcast.